Someone unmute Gregory.
All right, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, my name is Gregory, I'm addict. Recovery has allowed this inner city addict to education and a rewarding career. Through giving back, he found that his relationship with his community and his God are the keys to real success. I am so grateful that a God still hears an addict's prayer. My story is similar to many who have come before me and to many who will come after me. It is unfortunately typical of far too many urban African-American men. It includes a childhood characterized by crime, intravenous drug use, and a disease-imposed spiritual blackout. As a child, I knew God, but during my active addiction, my disease prohibited me from having a relationship with him. Growing up, I was attracted to the people in my community who lived the street life. I looked up to them and aspired to imitate them. This was certainly not the attitude of everyone else in my community. Several of my friends saw these people as nothing more than community bloodsuckers, worthy of neither praise nor respect. I had a sister and a brother with graduate degrees who served as excellent role models, so it is difficult to explain why I was drawn to the streets. Maybe it was the loneliness and emptiness I felt as a child, or maybe it was my longing for acceptance or my need to feel like I was somebody. Whatever the case, my obsession with the streets would ultimately lead to years of pain and misery. As a child, I felt isolated from my family and community and never really fit in with any particular component of society. I was always sad and depressed, and pot, to a small degree, freed me from my isolation, pain, and loneliness. Also, I was a puny kid who needed others in my life for protection from bullies and to feel accepted. Using provided me protection and acceptance. I never enjoyed smoking weed. It made me paranoid, caused me to act silly, and gave me the munchies. In spite of these unpleasant feelings, I continued because being accepted by my peers was an important value in my life at that time. In high school, I experimented with heroin and instantly replaced marijuana as my drug of choice. It seemed to relieve all my pain, anguish, and feelings of hopelessness. In the beginning, it freed me from need for protection because it gave me a false sense of toughness and courage. I committed crimes in order to support my habit. I would never have had the courage to do those things before. My addiction led to isolation from my family, association solely with other addicts, trouble with the law, and a complete disinterest in school. I dropped out of high school and traveled the country trying to find myself. I moved back and forth to Atlanta on three different occasions, the final time in 1984. I prayed that this time I would settle down, get myself together, and overcome my drug use. However, this disease has an agenda of its own. I returned to using drugs daily. I shared an apartment with my nephew and a friend. They were also addicts, and the three of us used together. One day after nearly overdosing and reaching the point where I became sick and tired of being sick and tired, I dropped to my knees and prayed that famous prayer. Please, God, help me. I am so grateful that a God still hears the addict's prayer. Shortly thereafter, I went to my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting. Since that day, God, the 12 steps, my sponsor, and the fellowship have all worked together to help liberate me from life of active addiction. Early in recovery, I learned the value of being involved in a fellowship and became active in NA service work, quickly becoming committed to helping others. I held a wide variety of service commitments. From these experiences, I gained confidence in my abilities to serve. My first real job was as a counselor. However, because I had less than a high school diploma, I was professionally limited. I was constantly being told that I did not have the credentials. My resentment prevented me from pursuing a degree. I believed that my life experiences and personal recovery was more valuable. Acting on suggestions from my sponsor, I finally decided to pursue my education. With this decision came several barriers and challenges. I had not been in school in almost 20 years, and I literally did not know where to begin. I dropped out of high school because school interfered with my mission as a full-time addict. Early in recovery, through prodding from many of the older members of the fellowship, I earned a GED. But I was 35 years old, and I felt I was too old to be starting a college career. I figured I would be somewhere in my 40s by the time I graduated. And I had no earthly idea of how I would attend school and financially support myself. However, I knew God had not delivered me from active addiction to leave me stuck in a dead-end job. I should have never made it to this point in my life. I should have been dead and buried, but because of God's grace and mercy, I was blessed with membership in Narcotics Anonymous. I was able to stay in good favor because of the direction I received from my sponsor, the 12 steps of NA, and my friends in recovery. Each had convinced me that God had positive plans for me, but I would have to remain obedient and trust him. This trust could only be amplified through daily practice of the principles of NA. College was extremely difficult. I had poor study habits. Actually, I had no study habits at all, and I didn't read very well. I could read the basic text and literature from the NA program, but no other literature held my interest. I was forced to become active in study groups, and this proved to be an additional challenge. My cohorts in study groups had no program, and it was difficult for me to interact with them. Studying in the library was hard for me. The silence would literally drive me crazy. Instead of studying, I would often find myself daydreaming. In spite of all these obstacles, through daily prayer and meditation, I was able to graduate with honors and get accepted into the master's program at a leading school of social work. Graduate school presented a new set of challenges for me. I wondered if I was smart enough and suspected my professors and the other students believed that I was there not because of my abilities, but because of affirmative action. I had issues with that relatively small number of African-American students on campus. I did not believe that the white students could identify with my experiences. I had similar experiences during the earlier years of my recovery, when there were only 10 to 12 African-Americans active in NA in my community. When race was raised as an issue, we were quickly reminded that addiction was an equal opportunity disease and that it affected us all, regardless of race. If we were to recover, we needed to discover a strategy that would allow us to do so in a manner where the influences of race and our racism would not impede our progress. In spite of these challenges, I graduated with a master's degree in social work. In one lifetime, God has allowed me two chances to live, and I am in a position to help others avoid some of the painful experiences I suffered through. To me, this is the greatest gift I have received. As a member of NA and as a social worker, I am charged with the responsibility of helping others. I mentioned that during my early days in Atlanta, I lived with my nephew and a friend. In 1991, my nephew died from complications of AIDS. Shortly thereafter, my friend was sentenced to 25 years to life in prison. Today, I am celebrating more than 21 years of NA recovery, and I am pursuing a PhD in social work. In addition, I serve as executive director of a recovery-based nonprofit organization that I founded. None of these accomplishments would have been possible without my higher power and the fellowship of NA. In the first 17 years of my recovery, I managed to gain every material thing a brother from the hood could dream of having, including a four-month internship in South Africa, where I was blessed with the opportunity to help grow the NA fellowship. However, during this period of material gain, I felt like I lost my soul. I had a higher power in my life, but I had no real relationship with him. Not the kind of relationship we discuss in our 11th step. One day when I was clean and miserable, I was introduced to other members of NA who spoke openly about their love for God and a connection between their belief in God and their recovery from addiction. They talked about spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. And that was important to me because I never believed I could meet or maintain standards that people of faith appeared to live by. Today, I don't compare my NA recovery, faith walk, or love for God with anyone else's. My relationship with the higher power is real and is personal. My agreement with him is that I would do my best. I would do the best I can a day at a time, and he will continue to help me along the way. Understanding my responsibility has been the spiritual awakening that I've discovered through working the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right, so help me welcome our next speaker, David W., the author of the story from Georgia. Welcome. I think you're unmuted now, David.
David, we can't hear you.
David.
Yeah, he's unmuted, but we can't hear him.
Knows he has a mic, so.
David, we can't hear you.
I'm clean today by the grace of the higher power. Working through the awesome program, Narcotics Anonymous. And for that, I'm just so grateful. I just want to thank the HP for leading me to NA, man, and thank NA for allowing me not just one chance to live, but two chances to live, man. Before I got to this program, I was dead. But as a result of Narcotics Anonymous, man, I'm alive, I'm joyous, I'm free, I'm happy. What else? I'm just like, you know, I'm just like full of gratitude, man. And I know the HP knew that I didn't need all that time that y'all was giving me to share. And I'm certain that's why we had the technical difficulties. It was either that or this cheap computer that I got, this laptop. I bought this laptop right after the pandemic because trying to Zoom or trying to go to meetings via the telephone just wasn't cutting it for me in my old eyes. And so I went out and bought a cheap laptop. You know what I'm saying? You get what you buy, you get what you pay for. And I think that's my experience. I think that's my story. Look, Jeremy, that was just an awesome share, brother. I'm glad I was able to hear that story. I've read that story before, and it feels so good to be able to put a face with the story. So thank you so much for being here. And Gregory B., man, you brought me to tears, brother. You had me like crying, man. It's like, I've actually heard that story read before. Not a whole lot of times, but once a long time ago, not that long ago. I mean, I guess when the story first came out, when the basic sixth edition first came out, I got a call from a group in Columbus, Ohio, and they wanted to know, and they read the basic text from the beginning to end. So that's what they do. They start at the beginning, they go to the end, and they start over. That's all their home group does, over and over and over again. And some kind of way or another, they found out that my story is in the basic text. I don't recall how. I don't talk about this a lot. I don't tell a lot of people like Jeremy, and I've heard other people who have stories in the basic text make the same claim that they don't talk about it a lot. I don't talk about it a lot. I've heard it talked about more since the pandemic than I had ever before. As a matter of fact, I'm happy to learn, I guess I'm happy, that my sponsor told me that he just recently learned that I had a story in the basic text and he's been my sponsor for more than 36 years. So I thought that was really cool that I had never even shared it with him. But one time, the group in Columbus, they said that they were going to read my story. And they wanted to know if I could come to Columbus and come to their home group. Like, I'm living in Atlanta. It's in February. So I jump on the plane. It's like, I got this little bitty jacket. It's like 60, 70 degrees in Atlanta. I get to Columbus and it's freezing. It's snow like up to my knee. And so I go to their group is on a Saturday morning, around 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock in the morning. And they start reading the story. I'm like hearing this story actually for the first time being read by someone other than me. And at the end of the reading, man, I was paralyzed. I couldn't say anything. I was just, I don't know what it was I was feeling. I don't know if starstruck is the right phrase, but it kind of caught me by surprise. And then one day I was at my home group and I was secretary in my home group. And my home group is really cool. It's a small group. It's a throwback meeting. We meet for 1 hour from 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock. At 6:55, we're saying the serenity prayer. By 7 o'clock, you know, the meeting is shut down. Everybody's leaving the building. It's a really cool meeting. It's small, but I like it. And one day I was secretary in the meeting, and traditionally we have somebody come in and share for 4 or 5 minutes. And then they pick a topic, and that's how the discussion takes place. Well, my discussion leader, the person we call who sits next to the secretary, didn't show up. And so I waited and waited, and they never showed up. So I just opened up the basic text, and I said, would it be okay if we read something from the basic text? And my home group said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. So I started reading my story. Some might think that that was a little egotistical, but really it wasn't. It was just like I was feeling it. So we passed the book around and people would read a paragraph and pass. And halfway through the story, one of my home group members screamed out. She said, is this you? And then another one of my home group members said, no, that ain't him, because if it was, he would have told us a long time ago. And I realized I had never even shared it with anybody in my home group. So it's just so cool. And to hear it read today makes me think about my nephew, who was really my brother. He and I were the same age. I had 10 siblings. I got 5 brothers. I got 5 sisters. I actually have a brother who's on this meeting here today. One of my heroes. This is the part where I get to say that we all got the same baby mom and the same baby daddy. I like that part because it's not uncommon. In many African-American communities, particularly when there's that many siblings that have several different daddies and several different mamas. That's not the case. My mom and daddy got all of us come from the same mom and daddy. And one of my sisters, my oldest sister, was having babies before I was a top. My oldest nephew, when I talk about my story, is older than my youngest sibling. So my mom and my sister was having babies at the same time. So that's the kind of family I come from. So my nephew was really like a brother. And we started shooting dope together when we was kids. And I don't know, we just doing our thing. And he ended up in Atlanta. Now, one of my older sisters had moved to Atlanta in 1972. My brother, who's on this Zoom meeting with us now, and one of my sisters, and 2 of their friends drove from Detroit, Michigan. I grew up in Pontiac, Michigan, to Atlanta to Dr. King's funeral in 1968, when the road from Detroit to Atlanta, which is now Major Highway 75, was only one lane going south and one lane going north. That's how far back my family goes. So my nephew had come here to live with my sister, and he lasted a few days because he was a drug addict, but he ended up getting a job in an apartment. I had never known him to have either. And when I got here, he wasn't shooting dope no more. He was drinking and smoking weed, so I figured he was cured. He wasn't shooting heroin. And so I talked him into getting one last shot. And that one last shot lasted for about a month. And he ended up going to jail because he stuck up a Kentucky Fried Chicken over in West Atlanta. And the other brother, who was a friend of ours, who we grew up with, will later end up getting 25 years of life in the penitentiary. My nephew would come home about 5 or 6 years after being locked up. And shortly thereafter, while he was in prison, he learned that he had contracted HIV as a result of being a dope user, a dope shooter. And he would eventually die June 1991. I would have had about 6 or 7 years clean then. But he died clean because when he came home from prison, he started going to Narcotics Anonymous meetings. My other friend, this story changed a little bit since the story in the basic text. My friend actually came home about, it's probably been about 6, 7, 8, 9 years now. He called me one day on my cell phone. And we talked. He told me he got my number from one of my brothers. And the next day, because I couldn't really tell if this was real or if I had dreamed it, I called the number back. And he was living in Ohio. He told me, yeah, I had called you yesterday. And we talked. I wanted to ask him, did he know anything about recovery or NA? Because we never talked about when we used. He said he was married, he was living in Ohio, that he was doing good. So when I hear that story, it brings back those memories, man. It brings back those thoughts. I remember early in NA in Atlanta, there were 10 Black people in Narcotics Anonymous. This was a town that was full of folks in NA. The authors of the basic text, at least those who were the major authors of the basic text anyway, lived in my town. I went to meetings with those cats. They were like rock stars. They had 5, 6, and 7 years clean. I was like, man, ain't no way in the hell I'm gonna be around here no 5, 6, 7 years. I can guarantee you that. My goal is to go to learn how to get loaded again on the weekends. And so I just got blessed. I was in a town with some quality recovery. It was a bit challenging in the beginning. Atlanta back in those days, people have heard me tell the story before. I got clean in July 1984, was a fairly segregated city. I know some people might find that hard to believe, but we have Black parts of town, we have white parts of town. when the Georgia region decided one day they wanted to have this fundraiser that was designed to foster unity throughout our region, try to find ways to bridge the gap between the Black Atlanta and the white Atlanta in NA, they sent a couple members out to find a central location in Metro Atlanta, and that's where we would have this fundraiser where we could bring everybody together. Well, the central location happened to be right in the heart of West Atlanta, which is nothing but the hood, straight hood. It's Black as, if you go to West Atlanta, you might think you're in Africa. That's how Black it is. And when they found out that that's where the central part of Metro Atlanta was, they decided to move the fundraiser to another part of town, a part of town that they thought was a little bit more safer. I understand, but that's what recovery was like for me in 1984. So early in recovery, I had this experience. We would go to this meeting place where all the NA meetings were held. There was a meeting there every single day. And somebody had handed me one of the readings. I was like, cool. But I didn't look at it. And then when I finally looked at it, it was one of the long ones. How it works maybe, or the traditions. And I started shaking like a leaf because I couldn't read. I was too afraid to tell anybody, except several of my Black friends knew that I couldn't read. I had shared that with them in confidence. And my friend, Folion, now in that big meeting up in the sky, came over to me. She said, it's okay, baby. She took it out of my hand and she handed me Who's an Addict. I learned to read in Narcotics Anonymous. One of the first things I learned to read was Who's an Addict. And I probably memorized it because I had heard it so much more than I could read it. Today, I have a GED. That's the degree that I'm most proud of. My friend, Players Little was his name. He asked me one day, he said, David, how old are you? I said, I'm 26. He said, man, I've been using longer than you've been alive. Scared the crap out of me. That sounded like a long time. And I knew I was beat down when I got to NA. I was miserable. I was tired of being tired. I was broke, man. I was not just, I'm not talking financially broke. I'm talking about spiritually broke, emotionally broke. And he said he had been using longer than I had been alive. And he said, man, we ain't gonna let you live your life like we lived ours. And he took me down to Georgia Tech and signed me up for a GED. I remember being in my GED class, and I raised my hand and asked the teacher, I said, how do you spell the? And the rest of the folks in there thought I was joking, but I was serious as I don't know what. School was interfering with me being a dope fiend. I figured I was going to die and up in the penitentiary. That's where the folks in my neighborhood went. They died or they ended up in the penitentiary. I didn't have nothing to look forward to. And I remember when I got my GED, in the meetings in Atlanta, they said, ask, does anybody have anything they want to talk about? In the beginning of the meeting, I would raise my hand. My friend Van said, Dave, if you're going to talk about that GED, you can't share. I talked about that GED every single day for 30 days straight. That was the single most proudest moment I had ever had in my life. I had, for the first time in my entire life, accomplished something. Did something that I believed might make my mama proud of me. And did something that I think that the higher power will be proud of me for. First time, man, I talked about that GED for like 30 days straight. People used to not go to the meets that they knew I was going to be at because they knew I was going to talk about it. And I just didn't talk about it. I shared forever. I would go on for like 5 minutes, 10 minutes talking about that GED. And then one day I had this job in recovery. It was cool. That was back in the days when you could get a job working in treatment because you were in recovery. I used to drive the van, drive the patients back and forth to meetings. That was cool. That's the funnest part of the job. I used to take them to all the NA meetings over in the hood. And this was like a white treatment program. And they used to love it. They had never seen nothing like that before. I would take them to the meetings over in the hood. And I would be going to a meeting myself. You know, I'd be sitting in the meeting sharing. I didn't know back then that I wasn't supposed to do that kind of stuff. I remember one day, a sponsor who's probably next to my old man, the smartest person I ever met before in my life. And my sponsor has an eighth grade education, dropped out of school in the eighth grade, ended up shooting heroin in Brooklyn. I loved him because he talked with a New York accent. He was Italian. He wasn't Italian. He is Italian. Came from Brooklyn, came from the ghettos in Brooklyn, New York. Spent several tours in Vietnam. And I just loved him, man. The first time I heard him share, I mean, I could immediately relate and identify with him, man. And just he told me, man, I told him about this sister that I was training at my job where I worked. She had a master's degree, I think it was probably in social work, some kind of counseling degree. She wasn't in recovery, but I was training her how to work with the clients. And I ran that past my sponsor. And he said, share that with me again. Okay, thanks. He said, share that with me again. And I told him that I was training a sister who had a master's degree and I had a GED. And he convinced me to go to school. And this is a brother who has an eighth grade education. So I eventually earned an associate's degree in social work. I got accepted to a special master's degree program at a major university. And I would later earn a PhD in social work from another major university, a real university, one where I have a 300-page dissertation. Not one of those ones where, now you can go to a Google search engine. I shouldn't be teaching on these bad habits. But you can go to a Google search engine and type in PhDs for sale and send in a $200 check and they'll send you a diploma. You can put it up on your wall. This is a real PhD with a real dissertation from a Research One institution. So I've literally gone from being a high school dropout, a hope to die dope fiend, a brother who couldn't read when he got to Narcotics Anonymous, to being a doctor. Folks used to call me Dave the Dope Fiend Shooting Dope. We don't know the meaning between water and soap. Now call me doctor. I laughed the first time one of my friends and then they called me doctor. I had to look around. I didn't know they were talking about me. I laughed. I'm just so thankful and so grateful that my story has come to fruition. I know my nephew is proud of me. I know he's wherever he's at. Know my nephew, he's probably in hell, but I probably shouldn't say that. Because he had made a major change in his life before he died. So chances are the merciful God that he shared, that he served is the same merciful God that I served. I'm sure that there's a heaven up above. That's where my nephew is. I know he's so proud of me. I know he is, man. And that's part of my motivation. That's part of the reason why I keep doing what I do, why I keep being active in Narcotics Anonymous. I ain't never not had a service position with the single exception of the years that I was in grad school in Michigan. Unless you count the 4-month internship that I completed in Durban, South Africa. I had never been nowhere before in my life. And they sent me to Durban for 4 months where I worked counseling addicts at a place called the AIDS Foundation for South Africa. This was back in the days when there was 1,500 new cases of HIV every single day in the country of South Africa. I worked counseling addicts who were getting infected with HIV as a result of their drug use. So I've been blessed beyond my wildest dreams. If I had wrote down on a piece of paper what I wanted when I got to Narcotics Anonymous, I would have shortchanged myself. This program has afforded me more than anything I could have ever dreamed of. I just thank the higher power for, again, for allowing me to be here. Thanks, Francis, for the invitation to be here. Thank you guys for what an awesome idea. I look forward to hearing some of the other remaining stories today. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.